I was at a data mining workshop actually in Banff a couple of weeks ago, a few weeks ago, and I interacted with people from industry. And following that, I figured that I should change a bit the content of my talk here so that I might be more interesting for people from industry. So actually, my talk is going to be trying to cater both crowds. And so the title that I've put down now is called Advances and Challenges, I should say some advances and some challenges in machine learning for high-dimensional data. Okay, so talking to data mining practitioners from industry, I realized that most of them were stuck in some little world. In fact, the whole theme of my talk is that we're all stuck in some little world. Even the academics, I'll talk about that in the second part. In the first part, I'm going to try to talk to the data mining practitioners about things that they might consider that are kind of outside of the box that they're usually considering, the usual box with logistic regression and decision trees, and suggest kind of paradigm shifts that might have a significant impact in their applications. So I'll say a few words about dimensionality reduction and spectral embedding, and this is going to be a topic I'll come back at the end of the talk when I'll discuss what Hugh mentioned about unsupervised learning techniques and manifold learning. I'll talk about semi-supervised learning and how that could be used when you have surveys. I'll talk about some ideas that have been floating around in the last few years in machine learning to do preference prediction and collaborative filtering. More generally, I'll try to present this as a kind of nonlinear factor analysis on pairs of objects. I'll also mention something which is not really in my field of expertise, but where I think that there are some really interesting applications that I'm investigating with some colleagues right now. And it has to do with taking advantage of things that have been done in what's called active learning and reinforcement learning for dealing with sequential decision taking. For example, I'll talk about marketing campaigns management. And then the last, probably longer part of my talk is going to be about some what I consider major challenges that people in machine learning have kind of forgotten mostly. Essentially, the message is going to be, well, there are these really hard, difficult learning problems trying to learn complex functions, and most of the things that people are trying probably don't have a chance to address these difficult problems, but we still have to try, and that's our role as academics. And I'll present some ideas to try to go in that direction. Right, so we're all very conservative by nature, even in universities, but in industry, I guess it's a question of survival. So if you've used tools that work well, you tend to stick with them. And that's too bad because there are many opportunities that people are missing. So I'll try to suggest some alternative ways to look at these data mining problems, especially having to do with things like marketing or related issues in which you have lots of customers and you're trying to predict something about them. One thing that is I don't have an easy answer about is that people in industry are usually very often stuck by simple software constraints. They're used to working with something like SAS or so, and it's hard in that context to try new things. I think one place where computer scientists can help is that for them it's easier to move beyond the software and add whatever other kind of code to the production line. Okay, I've said that already. So now let me say a few words about dimensional energy reduction. It's not going to be anything revolutionary for academics, but I want to explain why these things might be interesting for applications. First of all, you have to understand the problem of overfitting. I think it's not something I don't think to dwell too much on here. But one thing that people don't always realize is that even with large data sets that you may find in industry, and I have had a lot of experience with these things, you may have 100,000 records, even a million records, and you may think, well, this is really large. It's I don't need to worry too much about overfitting. Well, very often, in fact, you do have to worry a lot about overfitting because of two things. One is the presence of rare events. It could be that you're trying to do classification or probabilistic classification, and the class of interest is very rare. This is a very, very common occurrence. So if you have 1% of your interesting events in your large data set, it actually is a very small data set. And the other thing that may happen is you may have some variables, especially if it is the dependent variable, and I have dealt with that in insurance companies. The dependent variable may have thick tails. Again, you may have some rare events, for example, large claims, and that brings you into the overfitting regime, even though you may have millions of records. So what can you do about this? Essentially, you're in a situation where you have very often hundreds or thousands of variables, and the actual amount of information you have in data is not that large, so you can't really rely, the message I'm going to say, you can't really rely on purely non-parametric approaches. On the other hand, if you stick to linear models, it's very limiting. So what can you do? One thing that can be tried is to use dimensional key reduction. And there you have linear dimensional key reduction, people are familiar with, like PCA and factor analysis. And a lot of work has been done in recent years on nonlinear dimensional key reduction, so I'm going to spend some time talking about that. One thing about dimensional key reduction is that essentially what it tries to do is something really fundamental, trying to capture something about the distribution of the data, about the structure, geometric structure of the distribution of the data. And one way that people have been thinking about it in the last few years is trying to discover what's called manifold structure. So manifold being a region of high density in the data. You can think of one interesting way to think about manifold structure is just a generalization of clustering. What is clustering? Clustering is trying to find places of high density. Now, if you're lucky and you're in low dimension, you may actually have nice circular blob-like clusters. But in high-dimensional data sets, this is very rarely the case. Because of the geometry of high-dimensional spaces, if you had round clusters, they would all overlap completely with each other, or they would be so far from each other that it wouldn't be very realistic. What really happens in high dimension is that you're going to have concentration of density, but it's not going to be blob-like region, is going to be flat, locally flat region. And if you can discover these things, essentially what you're discovering are constraints on what the values of your variables can take. If you think about what happens when you have, when you say that in some region of space, the density is concentrated in some flat region, it means that there is a kind of linear relationship between some of the variables. So that's a kind of deterministic relation. So if you're able to find these things, you can capture a lot of information. And the first use that has been made of these things is just to do dimensional energy reduction, which means find a coordinate system in which a lower dimensional coordinate system that describes the data more or less. In particular, I'm going to talk about spectral embedding algorithms, which can sometimes take data like this, where you don't see the red curve, of course, just the crosses, and transform it into a space where things line up, and you can then express the points by their coordinate on a along the line, for example, if it's a one-dimensional manifold, but in general it's going to be, of course, higher dimensional. So you can get a more compact representation of the data, and that can help with the dimensionality problem, that can help with the overfitting problem, because now you can look at much fewer parameters for your model, whatever the model is going to be. But also, it raises some really interesting question about what learning is about and how we can go about discovering the structure of a complicated distribution that we don't know ahead of time. Okay, so let me say a few non-specific words about spectral embedding algorithms. There has been a lot of work on dimensionality reduction, and I'm going to focus here on a class of methods that have been proposed in the last 4 or 5 years, more or less, that allow to discover nonlinear manifolds. So this comes from a paper by Sam Rawlings, who's sitting in the back, and Larry Saul, Lawrence Saul, and illustrates the use of a method called LLE, in which the data actually lies on this 2D manifold in 3D space. This is just a toy problem to illustrate what the method does, and the points, the data are these colored points that we see projected on the screen, and the colors are just to show different regions on the manifold. What these algorithms do is they will assign each training point a new coordinate. Here we go from 3D to 2D, which is not very impressive, but you can think of doing this from 1000D to 10D or something. That would be really useful. And you can think of what these algorithms are trying to do is unfold this manifold and put it on a flat Euclidean frame. So now you get these coordinates for each training point, and you can see here that it pretty much recovered the structure of the data. And if we were to describe the data using these 2D coordinates rather than these 3D coordinates, it would be much easier to generalize properly about the characteristics of the data. Now, how do these methods work? So they all start by building some kind of neighborhood structure. These are local non-parametric methods. So they take all the data points, and they will build some kind of graph or neighborhood structure that says this guy is near to this guy, and so on. And this neighborhood structure, or this nearness information, is going to be summarized in a matrix on which we might do some transformations that we're going to call a Gram matrix, by analogy to what people have been calling a Gram matrix in kernel methods for supervised learning, like SVMs. In fact, it's the same kind of Gram matrix, except it's not always guaranteed to be positive definite, but I'm not going to have time to talk about that, but it's not a big issue here. And so we're going to get this matrix, and you can think of this matrix as having been obtained for each entry ij, for each pair of examples, by applying some function kd, where d is the data set, so it's a function that depends on the data set, and takes two examples, xi and xj, and returns a number. And you apply this function in all the examples, and you get a matrix. And then we just compute the principal eigenvectors of that matrix, and the entries in the eigenvectors will give us the coordinates of our examples. So the first eigenvector is going to be having one element for each training example, and it's going to give us the first coordinate for each example. The second eigenvector is going to give us the second coordinate, and so on. And we can take as many coordinates as we want. We don't have to redo computations if we want to do five-dimensional or six-dimensional or seven-dimensional, it's the same computation. Right. And these methods essentially differ by how these matrix is defined. But this matrix can think of representing some kind of notion of similarity. And there, I talked about LLE, there's ISOMAP. I'll come back to ISOMAP. I'll get some more specifics about ISOMAP later. There are lots of related techniques, Laplacian eigenmaps, spectral clustering, which is a method used not for dimensionality reduction, but for clustering. So it uses the same trick of projecting the data in this low-dimensional space, but the goal then is to separate and find clusters which may not be originally blobs, but may have flat, essentially each class lives on a manifold. Each cluster is a manifold. And kernel PCA, which is a slightly older technique, which has fundamental links with all of these. Okay. So one of the things I worked on a couple of years ago is how to, well, first of all, understand a little bit more what these techniques are really doing and how to generalize to new examples, because these techniques, most of them only tell you about the training points, which are unlabeled examples. But if you have a new point, you might not want to recompute everything, recompute eigenvectors. So it turns out that there's a very natural formula that you can use to express what the embedding should be for new examples, and it gives some insights about what these things are doing. And I'll use that insight later. So this formula called the Nystrom formula tells you that the case coordinate embedding for an example, a new example X, can be written as essentially a linear combination of the coordinates. So the V here are eigenvectors, the kth eigenvector for the ith element of the kth eigenvector. So this is essentially the coordinate of the kth of the ith, the kth coordinate of the ith training example. And these, remember, are these similarity this is the similarity function between x and xi. So if x is very close, this is going to be close to 1 if x is close to xi, it's going to be close to 0 when x is far from xi. So you can see it's kind of interpolating between the coordinates of the neighbors. So it's doing something very simple. But it has some mathematical justification. In particular, you can try to think about what happens when n goes to infinity, the number of examples, and this formula is an estimator of the eigenfunctions of this kernel. So there's something that happens when you go from eigenvectors to eigenfunctions as n goes to infinity. And if you're interested, I have a paper on this. Okay. So I'm just going to mention something I'll use later, which is once you have this formula, it actually tells you something about the geometry of the manifold. So this formula tells you how a new example is assigned a coordinate. Now, if you know how a new example is assigned a coordinate, you can also think about what if you were to change the point, how would that change the coordinate? So that tells you for one coordinate how things change in the embedding. Now, if the data were really lying on some manifold, and you think about what is this derivative, it tells you what happens when you move along the manifold, because x is going to be on the manifold, when you move along the manifold in the direction corresponding to this coordinate. So this is a vector which indicates the direction of movement in the direction of that coordinate on the manifold. If you take all of these vectors for all the coordinates, these are tangent vectors of the manifold at the point x. And now if you take all of these tangent vectors together and you look at the plane that they're spanning, this is the tangent plane of the manifold. So this embedding function tells you about the local geometry of the manifold. Okay, let me switch gears to another topic, semi-supervised learning, which is very closely connected to the previous one. So if there is manifold structure in the data, we can do unsupervised learning to find some lower dimensional representation. There's another thing we could do, which is take advantage of this manifold structure that we can get from unlabeled examples, but do it combining both the unlabeled data with labeled data. So the usual way that unsupervised learning has been used is we first do unsupervised learning, extract some feature or representation, and then we can use our labeled data for prediction using this representation as input. But another approach is to combine both steps in one shot. And this yields to semi-supervised learning. So suppose you have a large amount of unlabeled data. So in this figure, the stars and the crosses are unlabeled examples. And we only know the labels for the big circles. And forget about the squares. The squares are test examples, which we don't have yet. So we only have the labeled examples, the big circles. So if we only looked at the big circles and we were to build a classifier, we would probably build some kind of stupid classifier that goes like this. And it wouldn't be very good. But knowing the other points, which are unlabeled, so we don't know where their class is, we can build a much more precise classifier, which is going to really separate things, taking into account the structure of the manifolds. So you see there are these two manifolds, one per class. This is, everybody understand this picture? Okay. So what these algorithms are doing is essentially this. They're trying to reconcile two things. The nearness information that says that two points that are close to each other are likely to have the same class, to be of the same class, and the labels. So for some examples, we know what the right label is. And there are many algorithms that have been proposed to do that. And I'm just going to mention something that fits a certain class of them, in which you can explicitly write down the two things I talked about: the fact that you would like to find some kind of labels for all the data in such a way that examples that are near each other. So I'm going to have this W function say that xi and xj are near to each other. So if W is large, they're going to be close to each other, and if W is small, they're going to be far from each other. So I'm going to say for two points that are near, I'd like the label, so I'm going to call the label f of x. I'd like the label assigned to xi and xj to be close to each other, so this is going to be some kind of distance between f of xi and f of xj. And I'm going to be able, I want this for all the examples. And for the labeled examples, where I have a label yi, I would like yi to be close to f of xi. So this should be small. This distance should be small. This is one formalization of this idea, but it's being formalized in other ways that are much more complicated, which I won't describe here. And what you do then is you consider all of these f of xi as free variables, and you relax the constraint that the classes should be 0 or 1. You relax the f to be 0 or 1. You make f continuous so that you can solve this numerically. And you get, in the end, some numbers, say, between 0 and 1 for each example. And then you can threshold these numbers if you want to do classification. You can also, one thing we showed is that you can generalize this formula so that you'll be able to predict the class of a new example without having to re-solve this system. So to minimize this, when, for example, these quadratic can be done analytically with n cube computations, but you don't want to redo this for each new point that comes. So again, there's a way to generalize to new examples similar to what I talked about in the for manifold learning. Okay, so there's one application that I've been working on, and that is surveys. Lots of companies create surveys to collect information about their customers that they can't get otherwise, like do they use the competition's product, or would they prefer this kind of thing or that kind of thing or whatever. And usually surveys, one problem with surveys is that they're expensive and you only get a few thousand labeled examples. On the other hand, you have these maybe hundreds of thousands or whatever number of customers, you have other examples for which you don't know the answer to these questions. So that's that's an ideal application for semi-supervised learning. You have tons of unlabeled data, and you have a small set of labeled data. Now, one thing that we've worked on is how to speed up computation, because as I mentioned, these non-parametric techniques, they require something like order of n cubed computation, where n is the number of examples, total number of examples, including the n labels. Yes. You mean like text and stuff?
Well, yeah, or you know, that what they always talk about the marketing is what are the motivations, preferences,
sure.
What are the, I forget the exact terms they use. You know that about small subset of your customers, not just labels.
Yeah. Yeah, you can predict these things as well.
How you produce, I mean, this is not semi-supervised, this is semi-unsupervised, you know? Because you have this very rich unsupervised problem on the small
right.
subset and an unsupervised problem.
I agree. In fact, I think that the wave of the future is more work on unsupervised learning to capture these rich data sets and their complexities. You're absolutely right. In any case, what thing I was saying is that there are ways, there are computer scientist tricks to make approximations to these methods that will be much faster. And going to be essentially linear n and some quadratic and some other number. Right, let me move because I'm going to talk about another small topic which looks unrelated but is also related. So we've talked about embeddings for one object, but there are many cases where we get two kinds of objects at the same time. We get co-occurrences of two kinds of objects. And the typical thing you find in data mining application are users or customers and products. And you get some kind of co-occurrence of these two objects. So we know that this customer liked this product or bought this product or something like that. And there might be a third variable in addition to the customer and the product, which is just binary, he liked it or he didn't like it, or some other thing you observed for this pair. And you would like to predict this Z, this response variable, for any new pair XY. So you might just use some regular supervised learning technique with X and Y in input and predict Z. But what we've learned about dimensionality reduction and embeddings and so on might be useful here. In particular, it could also be useful for some kind of data analysis to understand better your population, your products, or your customers. So it would be nice to discover an embedding for your X's for your products and an embedding for your customers that kind of are related to each other, and ideally that live in the same space. So there are different things that have been proposed in this area, and I will not have time to go through them, but there are very interesting things that have been done in machine learning in the last few years relative to this question. And in particular, you may have heard about collaborative filtering, which is a special case where we only get to see for each customer what is the customer number, and for each product, the product number. That's all the information we have. But there are other variations on this idea. I'll talk about one, which is one approach which we are working on in my lab that is being applied to two kinds of problems. One is in pharmaceutical industry, where the X's are molecules that are candidate drugs, and the Y's are molecules that are protein receptors. So you can think of, we have a bunch of keys and a bunch of locks, and we know that with some noise, some keys go in some locks. So Z, the response variable, is the key did fit the lock. And we want to generalize to new pairs. So that's one application. Another that we're working on is in music preference prediction. So you have gigabytes and gigabytes of MP3s, and you also know that some people liked or listened to some music and didn't like or did not listen to other things, and you would like to be able to predict that such a person who did like such things and maybe answered a few questions about their taste or themselves or their demographics, would be interested in such and such music, so you can propose those musics to them. So, like in this other problem, we have more than just the identity of the X and the Y. We all have a lot of information, for example, about the music. We can extract a lot of acoustic information. We have some labels. And about the user, we have a lot of information as well, because we ask the user some questions. So one approach that we have developed is based on neural networks, which wouldn't be surprising for people who know me. And what we do is we take all the information available. So you can just think of it as one big supervised learning problem where we put all the information about the X, all the information about the Y in input, and we just try to predict the Z. So for each X, say, product, we're going to have both the number of the product, it's product number 35, and we're going to have some features about it that we know about this product, some characteristics of the product, like some acoustic features or whatever, or some geometric features for molecules. And same thing for the user, we have some kinds of information about the user, and we have the user number. So in this thing, we actually find two embeddings for each product and each user. First of all, we're going to have some parameters in the model that are essentially for each ID, for each product number, we're going to have a free vector, which is going to be an embedding. And we're going to learn this free vector for each product. And same thing for each user, we're going to learn its ID. An embedding, which is a vector in, say, R5 or whatever, which characterizes this user, but in such a way that when you combine this information with the features and through some linear or nonlinear transformation, you get now a kind of generic embedding into a space, which can be matched with the space associated to the product. So both the products and the users are going to have a position in this space, and these things should be comparable. Of course, they're going to be the same dimension. And say we can just do a dot product here or Euclidean distance to see whether these two things are close to each other in some sense. So when all of your features learned through this transformation essentially make you close to the features, learned features of the user, then we're going to say there's a high probability of a match. It's just a single number, which is the response, like whether the user liked the product, probability of, or something like that. And so one special case of this, when everything is linear and you don't have these things, is standard collaborative filtering, actually. And the thing is, now you can look at, you can take, say, all of your products and plot them on a 2D projection corresponding to these numbers, or 3D projection, and you can try to understand how products are related to each other in this space. Okay, time is running out. So I'm going to go quickly through this. There's an application that came to me recently of things that people in data mining don't usually pay attention to, and that is active learning and reinforcement learning. So the idea of active learning, for those who don't know, is simply that instead of getting all the data and then doing something with it, you're allowed to ask questions about the function you're trying to learn. So you're allowed to decide, for example, if you think about a company trying to know about its customers, the company is allowed to choose which customer they're going to ask for something. So if you're trying to learn a function f of x, you're allowed to choose the x on which you want to know about f of x. And of course, you have a limited budget of questions, and you want to use the answers to these questions to build a better predictor for new x's. So if you're trying to do classification, the obvious thing is that you want to ask more questions near the decision surface. Initially, you don't know where the decision surface is. There are algorithms that have been proposed. Essentially, try quickly focus on this region so that you can, in principle, actually, in the best case, you can learn about the decision surface using exponentially less examples than if you were to just get a random sample of your data and apply supervised learning, because you can zoom in on this quickly. And another related thing that may be useful, and I'll give an example of how useful it's reinforcement learning. So reinforcement learning is much has been worked on much more than active learning. It's a very rich field, and essentially it's about learning to take decisions in sequence when you only get information about whether your decisions were right or not later. And furthermore, the actions, the decisions you take may have impact on the future rewards. I mean, may interact with your future decisions through what we call a state. So there's a state variable, which you can think of the state of the environment. And when you take a decision, it may affect the state. And depending on the current state, you're going to see different things and you're going to get different rewards. So there are approaches in which you assume that you observe the state completely, and these are easier to deal with. These are called Markov decision processes. And there are other more realistic cases is you don't know everything about the state, and this is called partially observable Markov decision processes. And these are much harder to work with, but a lot of progress has been made in the last few years. It's generally not possible to come up with optimal algorithms for these things, but there are a lot of approximate or heuristically motivated algorithms that have been proposed and that have been successfully applied in industrial settings. And I think it's time that people in data mining consider these things. And I'll mention one application here, which has to do with marketing campaign management. So one thing that comes up in reinforcement learning that will also come up in this problem is the exploration-exploitation trade-off. So if you think of the state as just a space where you're allowed to move by your actions, if you know that in some states you're going to get a lot of reward, you could just go to these states and get this reward. But you might get even better reward if you go to other places you've never been. And so there's this trade-off between trying to go to places where you're not sure what you're going to get, so taking decisions that are more risky, but might give you more information, like in the active learning, we want to go to places where we can get more information. But at the same time, we have this reward. We can get more profit by taking some short-term decisions, and we can get short-term profit from these decisions, and we have to trade off these two things. So marketing campaigns usually occur in multiple phases, and each phase brings more information on the population. So one question is, when you do these marketing campaigns, who do you try to target? And there are two competing objectives. One is maximize short-term profit, and for this you would just like to target customers that are most likely to respond positively. But at the same time, because there are going to be these multiple phases, you might be more interested in maximizing model performance, that is, building up a model that characterizes your population as well as possible. And for this, you want to collect as much information about the population in general, or at least where it's more interesting in some sense. So you have these two objectives. So the real answer to this is eventually the answer that is found in reinforcement learning, which is you have to consider the overall goal, which is your cumulative profit. So depending on how many steps you're going to have and so on, the optimal strategy is going to be different. And I don't want to go much further, but there's been a lot of progress in this field that could be used for this problem. Okay, now let me go to the challenges for academics. Essentially, I'm going to talk about the curse of dimensionality, and I'm going to focus on one perspective, which is unsupervised learning and manifold learning, but I think it's a more general question, of course. How do we learn about complicated distributions that have structure that is not simple to capture in high dimension, and we don't have enough data to completely characterize it using just local information like we do in non-parametric learning? and the structure is complicated. So if we do parametric, well, either we really have a lot of information and we know about a lot about the structure ahead of time, but that's unlikely for most problems, or we just get it wrong. So this is difficult. So I mentioned earlier that we can get information about the tangent plane on a manifold if we have an embedding function ek of x by looking at its derivative. And if you remember the formula I had, if you just write the derivative, you get this formula, which is the same except I differentiated here with respect to x. So this is just a formula to tell us what are the tangent direction on the manifold if we have an embedding function ek of x for each point x that gives the embedding in the kth coordinate. And one thing that comes out when you analyze this formula, depending on the form of this k, which is going to be usually local, is that you find that these tangent direction then just depend on the neighbors of x. So if I think I have a picture. Yeah. So if I have a manifold and a point x, the way this tangent plane is going to be determined essentially is by looking at some neighbors of x and looking at the different vectors between x and its neighbors. And these different vectors essentially are going to span the tangent plane. So the tangent plane is going to be some linear combination of these different vectors x minus xi. And that's going to be true for all of the methods I talked about earlier. Now, why is that a problem? Let's see. I said I would talk about isomap, but I won't have time to. But I just to summarize, isomap is another of these methods for which it's less obvious that you have this property that the tangent plane is determined by the neighborhood, essentially. But it is. So let me go on. What is the consequence of this property? Consequence is that you're going to be hit by the curse of dimensionality. Now, at the level of the dimension of the manifold, not the dimension of the data. So that's already better. But if the manifold is not trivial dimensional, like if it's not two-dimensional or three-dimensional, but it's, say, 10 or 15 or 20-dimensional, then it's still going to be bad because things are going to be exponentially bad with the dimension. So what's happening, essentially, what this picture is trying to carry is that we're characterizing the geometry of the manifold by looking at each point, the neighbors of this point, and the neighbors tell us essentially the directions, the principal local principal directions. Okay, because the tangent plane at this point is going to be a linear combination of the difference vectors between a point and its neighbors. Okay, so you take some linear combination of these things, and that approximately will define the tangent plane. Which means that you need to think of it as characterizing the manifold as a bunch of local linear patches where you have to have enough points in each patch to determine those directions of variations. So now the question is, how many patches do you need given things like the dimensionality of the manifold and the structure, the curvature of the manifold? And of course the answer is pretty bad and it's pretty obvious. The other thing you have to consider is noise, because the data is not going to be perfectly lying on manifold for realistic applications. So you also need more data in each patch, not just to determine, because to determine those directions, if the data are not going to be strictly on the manifold, you need more data to average out this noise. And the thing now that really hurts is curvature. If the manifold is highly curved, then you need these patches to be really small, okay? If the manifold is very flat, you can have big patches. If the manifold is very curvy, then you need many small patches. How many examples do you need? Well, you need something like 1 over the radius of the manifold to the dimension of the manifold. And so that's pretty bad. Let me move on. So let me tell you now, that's going to be the only real new contribution that I'm going to talk about here. Let me talk about one approach that we've explored to try to deal with this problem. And the idea is that in order to fight this curse of dimensionality, well, since we cannot rely only on the local data, because there's not going to be enough in this local linear patch, we have to use information from somewhere else. And that comes from other data, which is not local. So to me, the only way around is to have some kind of algorithm that can take information about what is going on in one place of space and somehow gather some structure about it that generalizes in other places in space. So we just took this literally and said, well, the structure, well, one characteristic of the manifold is these tangent planes. So what a tangent plane can be characterized by a bunch of vectors. And so what we're going to do is we're going to have a function with some parameters that predicts those vectors for each point x. So for each x, we're going to have an f of x, which is going to be a bunch of vectors. So f is going to be, well, I guess I called it j, I'm sorry. So j of x is going to be a matrix d by n, which specifies the local tangent plane. So we're going to have a function with generic parameters. These parameters are going to be used all over the data space. And these parameters are going to tell us how to map an x, an input, to a matrix which specifies the tangent plane. And then we're going to say, well, let's just train this function. And so we just have to define a criterion. And one reasonable criterion is to say that when you take this matrix, the neighbors of x, like y, should be close to the plane that it defines. So the distance between the neighbors and the plane centered, I mean, that goes through x with those vectors should be as small as possible. And we also want to normalize so that we don't give more weight to points that are farther. So we just want to minimize essentially the angle made by neighbors with respect to this tangent plane. So this angle can be, this is the cosine or cosine square, whatever, of that angle. And it turns out this is just a quadratic in the F elements. So we can just do some kind of optimization of this criterion with respect to a particular class of functions. And these W's here are just the coordinates, local coordinates of the neighbor on the plane that we can find easily by minimizing this thing over W. So we can find for each neighbor of X where it lands on the plane, and W tells us these local coordinates. And we just want to make sure now that this distance is small compared to this distance. And so we minimized this over a class of functions, and we did experiments with different kinds of neural nets as predictors. And these are toy experiments first to show what it essentially is doing. I don't know if the points are too small for people to see in the back, but the training examples is 2D data so that we can visualize it. The training examples are red points. Can you see the red points? Oh, well, there are some red points scattered. And these red points happen to actually come from different sinusoids that are at different heights. And the blue things, are these small vectors, are the predictions learned by this model about what the tangent vector should be at any position. So it learns a kind of, flow diagram of where it expects, how it expects to see changes in the embedding function. It actually recovers essentially the structure of the differential structure of the manifolds here. Now, what is more interesting is we have applied this to more real data that are images of digits. So if we take a bunch of images that are slight rotations of each other, and we train, we take all of these images as training unsupervised examples to these methods, including local local methods that can do this as well, parametric, non-parametric local methods. And well, first we can just like look at numbers that tell us essentially the this average projection error. This is the one we get with our algorithm, and this would be the ideal one if we knew the true tangent plane, and this is the error you get with a non-parametric local method. Now, the really interesting part is we've trained this on the digits, the 10 digits from MNIST. But then, so what it was learning, because it saw rotations of images, and here it's hard to interpret, but these are the tangent vectors that it learned. The funny thing now is we've applied this to new images of classes that it had never seen. So it was trained on digits, and then we say, well, what does it predict in terms of the manifold structure of rotation, because that's what it saw in the data, for characters, for non-digit characters. So if you take, for example, letter M, and you apply these transformation that it has learned to the character M, you get essentially rotated M, pretty much a rotated M. If you were to use one of the local methods on this, it fails completely. So these are supposed to be slightly rotated and more rotated using those tangent directions. So following those tangent directions by small steps, you can kind of approximate the trajectory on the manifold. So the thing that's really interesting is that it has learned about rotation of images based on digit images, and it has learned something really more general than for these specific classes. It has learned something that applied to objects that were very far in space. So it's really learned something more general, something that it would be completely hopeless to learn using a purely local non-parametric approach. So that's, I thought, really fascinating. And essentially the reason is we have this parameterization in which the parameters are not specific to what happens in one place, but what has been, but they are reused over the whole of space. So what you've learned in one place could potentially be generalized by the model to a completely different place. Now, it doesn't mean that it can generalize properly. I mean, it's like any generalization problem, but at least there's a potential for generalization to really remote places if there is some generic structure that it's able to capture. Now, of course, when we do this, we fall into potentially difficult optimization problems. It was not the case in these experiments, but now we are out of the nice and beautiful world of convex optimization that is so popular these days in machine learning. But I think that if we don't let us try these things that are harder, we might miss on really important opportunities to address these hard problems I was mentioning at the beginning of my talk, trying to learn complex distributions and their structure when we don't have enough prior knowledge to really make it up. So I would like to end with two messages. Basically, get out of your local minimum. For people in data mining industry, there are lots of interesting things that have been going on in machine learning that can be viewed as really different paradigms. And for people in machine learning, I think it's time to come back to really more ambitious and hard questions like those that are raised by the curse of dimensionality, even if we go out of the nice world of things like convex optimization. We have to try these difficult problems because this is our role. This is why the government pays us. So this is the end of my talk.